aesthetics, politics, morality, epistemology, metaphysics? Should you devote your time to teaching, to producing a body of work, to research, to culture? It makes no difference. The only thing that matters is your intention. Are you elevating thought and contributing to the common good? Or rather, joining the ranks in a field of study whose only purpose is its own perpetuation, and only function, the self-reproduction of a sterile elite? For this turns the university into a sect.
Profound thought number 14. Go to Angelina's to learn why cars are burning. Something really fascinating happened today. I went to see Madame Michelle to ask her to bring some mail for Colombe up to the house once the courier delivers it to her loge. In fact, it's Colombe's master's thesis on William of Ockham. It's a first draft that her director was supposed to read and send back with comments. What's really funny is that Madame Michelle told Colombe to take a hike because she rang at the loge at 7 in the morning to ask her to bring up the package. Madame Michelle must have told her off, the loge opens at 8, because Colombe came back to the house like a fury, ranting that the concierge was an old scumbag, and who did she think she was anyway? And have you ever seen such a thing? Maman seemed to recall suddenly that, yes, indeed, in an advanced, civilized country, you don't go disturbing concierge at any old hour of the day or night. And she would have done better to remember that before Colombe went down there. But that didn't calm my sister down, and she went on bleating that just because she'd goofed up on the time didn't mean this non-entity had the right to slam the door in her face. Maman just let it go. If Colombe were my daughter, Darwin forbid, I would have slapped her on both cheeks. 10 minutes later, Colombe came into my room with a really gooey smile on her face. Now that is one thing I really cannot stand. I'd even rather she yelled at me. Paloma, sweetie, can you do me a really big favor? She cooed. No, I answered. She took a deep breath, rueing the fact that I am not her personal slave. Why, she could have had me horsewhipped, which would have made her feel a lot better. What an irritating, snotty-nosed kid. Let's make a deal, I added. You don't even know what I want, she retorted with a scornful little smirk. You want me to go see Madame Michelle, I said. She sat there with her mouth open. She's told herself so long that I'm a retard that she's finally ended up believing it. I'll do it if you don't play loud music in your room for a month. A week, said Colombe. Then I won't go, I said. Okay, said Colombe. Go see that old bag and tell her to bring me Marianne's package the minute it comes to her loge. And she went out, slamming the door behind her. So I went to see Madame Michelle, and she invited me in for a cup of tea. For the time being, I'm testing her. I didn't say much. She gave me a strange look, as if she were seeing me for the first time. She didn't say anything about Colombe. If she were a real concierge, she would have said something like, "Yes, well, your sister there shouldn't go thinking she can get away with whatever she likes." Instead, she gave me a cup of tea and talked to me very politely, as if I were a real person. The television was on in the loge. She wasn't watching it. There was a program about kids burning cars in the banlieue. When I saw the images, I wondered what it is that makes a kid want to burn a car. What is going on in their heads? And then this thought came into my mind. What about me? Why do I want to set fire to the apartment? Journalists talk about unemployment and poverty. I talk about the selfishness and duplicity of my family. But these are all hollow phrases. There have always been unemployment and poverty and pathetic families. And yet, people don't go burning cars or apartments every day of the week. Honestly, I figured that, in the end, they were all false pretexts. Why do people burn cars? Why do I want to set fire to the apartment? I didn't get an answer to my question until I went shopping with my Aunt Hélène, my mother's sister, and my cousin Sophie. In fact, we had to go buy a present for my mother's birthday, which is next Sunday. The pretext was a visit to the Musée d'Appel, but we went straight to the interior design boutiques in the 2nd and 8th arrondissement. The idea was to find an umbrella stand and buy my present for Maman as well. As for the search for an umbrella stand, it was endless. It took 3 hours, but if you ask me, all the stands we saw were absolutely identical, either really basic cylinders or things with ironwork like you'd find in an antique store, and all of them ridiculously expensive. Don't you find it disturbing on some level to think that an umbrella stand can cost 289 euros? And yet, that is what Hélène paid for this pretentious object in fatigued leather. My foot, rubbed with an iron brush, maybe. With saddle maker stitching, as if we lived on a stud farm. And I bought Maman a little black lacquer box for her sleeping tablets from an Asian boutique. 30 euros. I already thought that was really expensive, but Hélène asked me if I wanted to get something else to go with it, since it wasn't a lot. Hélène's husband is a gastroenterologist, and I can guarantee that, in the realm of medical doctors, gastroenterologists are not among the poorest. All the same, I like Hélène and Claude, because they are, well, I don't know quite how to put it. They have integrity. They are satisfied with their life, I think. At least they don't play at being something they're not. And they have Sophie. Sophie has Down syndrome. I'm not the sort who gets all sentimental around people with Down syndrome the way some people in my family do. They think it's good manners. Even Colombe joins in. The consensual script reads, "They are handicapped, but they are so endearing, so affectionate, so touching." Personally, I find Sophie's presence somewhat hard to take. She drools, she cries out, gets moody, has her whims, and doesn't understand anything. But that doesn't mean I don't admire Hélène and Claude. They themselves admit that she is difficult and that it is a real ordeal to have a daughter with Down syndrome. But they love her and do a great job looking after her, I think. This, along with their integrity, well, the result is that I really like them a lot. When you see Maman playing at being the hip, well-adjusted modern woman, or Jacinthe Rosin playing at having been born with a silver spoon stuck in her mouth, it makes Hélène, who is playing at nobody at all, and who is content with what she has, seem really likable. Anyway, after the rigmarole with the umbrella stand, we went to eat some cakes and drink hot chocolate at Angelina's, a tea room on the Rue de Rivoli. You'll tell me that nothing could be further removed from the topic of young people in the banlieue burning cars. Well, not at all. I saw something while we were at Angelina's that offered me a lot of insight about other things. At the table next to ours, there was a couple with a baby. The couple were white, and their baby was Asian, a little boy they called Teo. They struck up a conversation with Hélène and chatted for a while. Obviously, they had in common the fact that their children were different. That is why they noticed each other and began to converse. We learned that Teo had been adopted. He was 15 months old when they brought him home from Thailand. His parents had died in the tsunami, along with all his brothers and sisters. I was looking around and thinking, how will he manage? Here we were at Angelina's, after all these well-dressed people, nibbling preciously at their exorbitantly priced pâtisserie, who were here only for, well, for the significance of the place itself. Belonging to a certain world, with its beliefs, its codes, its projects, its history, and so on. It's symbolic. When you go to have tea, chez Angelina, you are in France, in a world that is wealthy, hierarchical, rational, Cartesian, policed. How will little Teo manage? He spent the first months of his life in a fishing village in Thailand, in an Eastern world dominated by its own values and emotions, where symbolic belonging might be played out at village feasts celebrating the rain god, where children are brought up with magical beliefs, etc. And now here he is in France, at Angelina's, suddenly immersed in a different culture without any time to adjust, with a social position that has changed in every possible way. From Asia to Europe. From poverty to wealth. Then suddenly I said to myself, Teo might want to burn cars someday. Because it's a gesture of frustration and anger. And maybe the greatest anger and frustration come not from unemployment or poverty or the lack of a future, but from the feeling that you have no culture, because you've been torn between cultures, between incompatible symbols. How can you exist if you don't know where you are? What do you do if your culture will always be that of a Thai fishing village and of Parisian grand bourgeois at the same time? Or if you're the son of immigrants, but also the citizen of an old conservative nation? So, you burn cars. Because when you have no culture, you're no longer a civilized animal. You're a wild beast. And a wild beast burns and kills and pillages. I know this is not a very profound thought, but after that, I did have a profound thought all the same. I asked myself, what about me? What is my cultural problem? In what way am I torn between two incompatible beliefs? And in what way am I a wild beast? And then I had an enlightened thought, thinking of Maman's incantatory care of her green plants, and Colombe's phobic manias, and Papa's stress over Mamie being in a retirement home, and a whole lot of other things like that. Maman thinks you can conjure your destiny just by going, psht. And Colombe thinks you can push your cares to one side just by washing your hands. And Papa thinks he's a bad son who will be punished because he's abandoned his mother. In the end, they too have magical beliefs, the beliefs of primitive people. But unlike the Thai fishermen, they can't accept them, because they are rich, educated, Cartesian French people. And I am probably the biggest victim of all of this contradiction, because for some unknown reason, I am hypersensitive to anything that is dissonant, as if I had some sort of absolute pitch for false notes or contradictions. This contradiction and all the others. As a result, I don't feel I belong to any belief system, to any of these incoherent family cultures. Maybe I'm the symptom of the family contradiction, and so I'm the one who has to disappear, if the family is to prosper.
Chapter 4. The First Principle. By the time Manuela comes down from the De Broglie's at 2 o'clock, I have put the thesis back into its envelope and dropped it off at the Josse. This gave me the opportunity for an interesting conversation with Solange Josse. You will recall that, as far as the residents are concerned, I am a stubborn concierge who lurks somewhere at the blurry edges of their ethereal vision. Solange Josse is no exception to this rule, but because she is the wife of a socialist member of parliament, she nevertheless makes an effort. "Good morning," she says, as she opens the door and takes the envelope I hand to her. An effort, as I said. "You know," she continues, "Paloma is a very eccentric little girl." She observes me, checking to see if I am familiar with this word. I assume a neutral expression, one of my favorites, for its wide latitude of interpretation. Solange Josse may be a socialist, but she does not believe in mankind. "What I mean is that she is a bit strange," she articulates carefully, as if talking to someone who is hard of hearing. "She is a very sweet child," I say, taking it upon myself to inject a bit of philanthropy into the conversation. "Yes, yes," replies Solange Josse in the tone of someone who would like to get to the point, but must first overcome a number of obstacles stemming from the other person's lack of culture. "She's a sweet little girl, but she often behaves rather strangely. She loves to hide, for example. She disappears for hours." "Yes, she told me." A slightly risky reply, compared with the strategy that advocates saying nothing, doing nothing, understanding nothing. But I think I can play the part without betraying my nature. Oh, she told you? Suddenly, Solange just sounds rather vague. How can she find out what the concierge has inferred from what Paloma might have said? The question mobilizes her cognitive resources, causing her to lose her concentration and making her look quite absent-minded. Yes, she told me, I reply. You have to admit I have a certain gift for laconicism. I catch a glimpse of Constitution behind Solange Josse, sneaking slowly up to the door with a blasé look on her face. Oh, watch out, the cat, she says. And she comes out onto the landing and closes the door behind her. Don't let the cat out or the concierge in. This is the first principle of socialist ladies. Anyway, she continues, Paloma told me she would like to come to your loge from time to time. She daydreams a lot and likes to settle somewhere and do nothing. To be honest, I really would prefer she did that at home.
Ah.
But from time to time, if it's not a bother, that way at least I'll know where she is. She drives us all mad, making us look all over for her. Colombe is up to here in work, and she's not too keen on having to spend hours moving heaven and earth to find her sister. She opens the door a crack, ascertains that Constitution has moved on elsewhere. Are you sure you don't mind? She asks, her thoughts already elsewhere. No, I reply. She won't disturb me. Oh, good, good, says Solange Josse, whose attention is now most definitely being solicited by a far more urgent and interesting matter. Thank you so much. It's very kind of you. And she closes the door. Chapter 5. The Antipodes. After that, I get on with my duties as concierge. And for the first time all day, I have time to think. Yesterday evening comes back with a curious aftertaste. After a pleasant aroma of peanuts, come the stirrings of a dull anxiety. I try to ignore it by concentrating on watering the houseplants on every landing in the building. This is the very type of chore that I situate at the antipodes of human intelligence. At 1:01, Manuela arrives, looking as excited as Neptune when he espies a zucchini peel in the distance. Well, she says several times impatiently, handing me some madeleine in a little round wicker basket. I'm going to need your services again, I say. Oh, really? She says, insisting heavily, almost unintentionally, on the real. I have never seen Manuela looking so excited. We're having tea together on Sunday, and I'm in charge of the pastries, I explain. Ooh, she says, radiant. The pastries. And immediately, pragmatic. I'll have to make you something that will keep. Manuela works Saturdays until lunchtime. Friday night, I'll make you a glutov, she declares, after a brief pause for reflection. The glutov is a rather voracious Alsatian cake. But Manuela's glutov is ambrosia as well. Everything that is dry and heavy about Alsace is transformed by her hands into an aromatic masterpiece. Will you have time? I ask. Of course, she says, over the moon. I always have time for a glutov for you. And so I tell her everything. How I arrived, the still life, the sake, Mozart, the gyozas, the Zalu, Kitty, the Munikata sisters, and everything else. If you have but one friend, make sure you choose her well. You are amazing, says Manuela, when I have finished my story. All the idiots in this building, and now you, for once there is a decent gentleman here, you are the one who was invited to his place. She gulps down a madeleine. Ha! She exclaims suddenly, insisting heavily on the H. I'll make you a few whiskey tarts. No, please, don't go to so much bother, Manuela. The glutov will be plenty. So much bother, but Renee, you are the one who has been going to a lot of bother for my sake all these years. She pauses for a moment, as if trying to remember something. What was Paloma doing here? She asks. Well, she was taking a rest from her family. Oh, the poor kid. You have to admit that with that sister of hers. Manuela's feelings about Colombe, she would gladly burn her bag lady hand-me-downs and then send her out into the fields for a little cultural revolution, are unequivocal, to say the least. The little Pallière boy stands there gaping whenever Colombe walks by, she adds. But she doesn't even see him. He should put a garbage bag on his head. Oh, if only all the young women in the building were like Olympe. That's true. Olympe is a very sweet girl. Yes, she's a good sort. Neptune had the runs on Tuesday, you know. And she really took care of him. One mere run on its own would have been far too stingy. I know. We're good for a new carpet in the hallway. They're delivering it tomorrow. No harm done there. The other one was dreadful. You know, says Manuela, you can keep the dress. The lady's daughter said to Maria, keep everything. And Maria told me to tell you that she's giving you the dress. Oh, that's very kind, but I can't accept. Don't go on about that again, says Manuela, annoyed. In any case, you'll have to pay for the dry cleaners. Just look at that. It looks like an orange. The orange, it would seem, is a virtuous type of orgy. Well, then, please thank Maria for me. I'm really very grateful. It's better like this. Yes, yes, I'll thank her for you. Two sharp knocks at the door. Chapter 6. Baby Porpoise. It is Kakuro Ozu. Hello, hello, he says, bursting into the loge. Oh, hello, Madame Lopez, he adds, upon seeing Manuela. Hello, Monsieur Ozu, she replies, almost shouting. Manuela is a very enthusiastic sort. We were having tea. Will you join us? Ah, with pleasure, says Kakuro, grabbing a chair. And when he sees Leo, oh, what a fine specimen. I didn't see him properly the other time. A regular sumo. Have a Madeleine. They're made with orgy, says Manuela, who's getting everything mixed up as she pushes the basket in Kakuro's direction. The orgy, it would seem, is a vicious type of orange. Thank you, says Kakuro, as he takes one. Marvelous, he exclaims, the moment the Madeleine has disappeared down his throat. Manuela wriggles on her chair, blissfully happy. I have come to ask your opinion, says Kakuro, after four Madeleines. I am in the midst of an argument with a friend over the issue of European supremacy in matters of culture. He sends a graceful wink in my direction. Manuela ought to be more indulgent with the Pallière boy in future. She is sitting there gaping. He leans toward England, and obviously I am for France, so I told him I knew someone who could settle the matter between us. Would you mind being the referee? But I'm a judge and being judged at the same time, I say, sitting down. I can't vote. No, 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 you're not going to vote. Just answer my question. What are the two major inventions of French and British culture? Madame Lopez, I'm fortunate indeed this afternoon. You can give me your opinion, too, if you would. The English, Manuela begins, in fine fettle. Then she pauses. You go first, René, she says, suddenly remembering, no doubt, that she is Portuguese and that she ought to be more careful. I reflect for a moment. Where France is concerned, the language of the 18th century, and soft cheese. And England, asks Kakuro. Oh, England will be easy, I say. Pudding, says Manuela, spicing the dessert with her accent. Kakuro bursts out laughing. No, we need something more. Then the rugby, she says, savoring every syllable. Ha ha, laughs Kakuro. I totally agree with you. And you, Renee, what do you suggest? Habeas corpus and lawns. I laugh. And this sends us off into another fit of giggles, including Manuela, who heard baby porpoise, which is strictly beside the point, but it makes her laugh all the same. At that very moment, someone knocks at the loge. How extraordinary that this loge, which yesterday was of no interest to anyone, seems today to be the focus of global attention. Come in, I say without thinking, in the heat of the conversation. Solange Josse looks in around the door. All three of us look at her questioningly, as if we were guests at a banquet being disturbed by an ill-mannered servant. She opens her mouth, then thinks better of it. Paloma looks in around the door at the height of the lock. I remember myself and get to my feet. May I leave Paloma with you for an hour or so? Asks Madame Josse, who has recovered her composure, albeit her curiosity needle has gone right off the gauge. Bonjour, Monsieur Ozu, she says to Kakuro, who has risen to his feet and come to shake her hand. Bonjour, chère Madame, he says kindly. Hello, Paloma, how nice to see you. Well, dear friend, she'll be in good hands. You can leave her here with us. How to send someone gracefully on their way in one lesson.
Okay, well, yes, thank you, says Solange Josse, stepping slowly back, still somewhat stunned.
I close the door behind her. Would you like a cup of tea? I ask Paloma.
I'd love one.
A true little princess among high-ranking party members. I pour her half a cup of jasmine tea, while Manuela plies her with the few remaining madeleine.
What did the English invent, do you think? Kakuro asks her, still at it with his cultural contest.
Paloma sits lost in thought.
The hat, as a symbol of stubborn resistance to change, she says.
Excellent, says Kakuro.
I note that I have probably greatly underestimated Paloma, and that I will have to dig deeper. But since destiny always rings three times, and since all conspirators are doomed to be unmasked someday, there is once again a drumming at the window of the loge, and I am distracted from my thoughts. Paul Nguyen is the first person who does not seem to be surprised by anything.
Good morning, Madame Michel, he says. Then, hello, everybody.
Ah, Paul, says Kakuro. We have definitely discredited England.
Paul smiles gently.
Very good, he says. Your daughter just rang. She'll call again in 5 minutes.
He hands him a cell phone.
I see, says Kakuro. Well, ladies, I must take my leave.
He bows. Goodbye, we offer in unison, like a virginal choir. Well, says Manuela, that's a job well done.
What job? I ask.
We've eaten all the madeleine.
We laugh. She looks at me thoughtfully and smiles. It's incredible, isn't it?
Yes, it is incredible.
Renee, who now has two friends, is no longer so shy. But Renee, with her two friends, feels a sudden, undefined terror welling up inside. When Manuela has gone, Paloma curls up in Leo's armchair in front of the television, quite at home, and looking at me with her big, serious eyes, she asks,
Do you believe that life has meaning?
Chapter 7. Deep Blue. At the dry cleaners, I had had to confront the wrath of the lady of the premises.
Spots like this on such a quality item, she had grumbled, handing me a sky blue receipt.
This morning I hand my rectangle of paper to a different woman, younger and dozier. She hunts endlessly through the serried rows of hangers, then brings me a lovely dress in plum linen, wrapped tightly in transparent plastic.
Thank you,
I say, picking up said item after an infinitesimal hesitation.
To the chapter of my turpitudes, I must now add the abduction of a dress that does not belong to me, in place of one stolen from a dead woman by me. The evil is rooted, moreover, in the infinitesimal nature of my hesitation. If my vacillation had been the fruit of a sense of compunction linked to the concept of ownership, I might yet be able to implore St. Peter's forgiveness. But I fear it is due to nothing more than the time needed to ensure the feasibility of my misdeed.
At 1 o'clock, Manuela stops by the loge to drop off her Glutov.
I wanted to come earlier, but Madame de Broglie was looking at me out of the corner.
According to Manuela,
The corner of her eye is a superfluous clarification. As far as Glutovs are concerned, nestled amidst a profusion of rustling deep blue tissue paper are a magnificent Alsatian cake, succulent with inspiration, some whiskey tarts, so delicate you hesitate to touch them for fear they will break, and some almond tuile, crisply caramelized on the edges. The sight of these treasures instantly causes me to drool. "Thank you, Manuela," I say, "but there will only be the two of us, you know." "Well, then, just start in right away." "Thanks again, really. It must have taken you a lot of time."
"Fil-di-di! I made two of everything, and Fernando has you to thank."
Journal of the Movement of the World, number 7. This broken stem that for you I loved. While having breakfast, I saw a movement. The movement. Perfection of movement. Let me explain. This is a somewhat special movement of the world, because it's not about a movement of the body. Yesterday, it was Monday, Madame Clément, the cleaning lady, brought Maman a bouquet of roses. Madame Clément spent Sunday at her sister's, and her sister has a little allotment garden in Sirens, one of the last ones, and she brought back a bouquet of the first roses of the season. Yellow roses, a lovely pale yellow, like primroses. According to Madame Clément, this particular rosebush is called the Pilgrim. I already like that for a start. It's loftier, more poetic, less sappy than calling a rosebush Madame Figaro or Un Amour de Proust. I'm not making this up. Okay, I won't go into the fact that Madame Clément offers roses to Maman. They have the same relationship that all progressive middle-class women have with their cleaning ladies, although Maman really thinks she is the exception. A good old rose-colored paternalistic relationship. We offer her coffee, give her decent pay, never scold, pass on old clothes and broken furniture, and show an interest in her children. And in return, she brings us roses and brown and beige crocheted bedspreads. But those roses, they were something else. I was having breakfast and looking at the bouquet on the kitchen counter. I don't believe I was thinking about anything. And that could be why I noticed the movement. Maybe if I'd been preoccupied with something else, if the kitchen hadn't been quiet, if I hadn't been alone in there, I wouldn't have been attentive enough. But I was alone, and calm, and empty, so I was able to take it in. There was a little sound, a sort of quivering in the air that went, shh, very, very, very quietly. A tiny rosebud on a little broken stem that dropped onto the counter. The moment it touched the surface, it went puff, a puff of the ultrasonic variety for the ears of mice alone, or for human ears when everything is very, very, very silent. I stopped there with my spoon in the air, totally transfixed. It was magnificent. But what was it that was so magnificent? I couldn't get over it. It was just a little rosebud at the end of a broken stem, dropping onto the counter. And so? I understood when I went over and looked at the motionless rosebud where it had fallen. It's something to do with time, not space. Sure, a rosebud that has just gracefully dropped from the flower is always lovely to look at. It's so artistic. You could paint them over and over. But that doesn't explain the movement. The movement. And we think such things are spatial. In the split second while I saw the stem and the bud drop to the counter, I intuited the essence of beauty. Yes, here I am, a little 12-and-a-half-year-old brat, and I have been incredibly lucky because this morning, all the conditions were ripe. An empty mind, a calm house, lovely roses, a rosebud dropping. And that is why I thought of Ronsard's poem, though I didn't really understand it at first, because he talks about time and roses, because beauty consists of its own passing, just as we reach for it. It's the ephemeral configuration of things in the moment, when you can see both their beauty and their death. Oh my gosh, I thought. Does this mean that this is how we must live our lives? Constantly poised between beauty and death, between movement and its disappearance? Maybe that's what being alive is all about, so we can track down those moments that are dying.
Chapter 8. Contented Little Sips. And now we are Sunday. At 3 in the afternoon, I make my way to the fourth floor. The plum-colored dress is slightly too big. A godsend on a Glutov day, and my heart feels as tight as a kitten rolled into a ball. Between the third and fourth floor, I find myself face to face with Sabine Ballière. Over the last few days, whenever she has run into me, she has openly and disapprovingly scrutinized my puffy hair. Might I mention that I have abandoned the idea of hiding my new appearance from the world? But such determination puts me ill at ease, however liberated I might be. Our Sunday encounter is no exception to the rule. Good afternoon, Madame Ballière, I say, carrying on up the steps. She answers with a stern nod as she considers my sconce, and then, noticing how I am dressed, she stops short on the step. A wave of panic assails me, deregulating my sudatory glands and threatening my stolen gown with the infamy of underarm rings. As you are headed that way, would you water the flowers on the landing? She asks, in an exasperated tone of voice. Must I remind her it is Sunday? Are those cakes? She asks, suddenly. On a tray, I am carrying Manuela's masterworks, wrapped in navy blue tissue paper, and I realize that in Madame Palliere's eyes, this far surpasses my dress, and that it is hardly my pretension to elegance which is arousing Madame's condemnation, but some wastrel's greedy appetite. Yes, an unexpected delivery, I say. Well then, take advantage of it to water the flowers at the same time, she says, and resumes her irritated descent. I arrive at the fourth floor and find it somewhat awkward to ring the bell, as I am also carrying the video cassette. But Kakuro opens diligently for me and immediately relieves me of my cumbersome tray. Oh my goodness, he says. You don't mess around. My mouth is watering already. You'll have to thank Manuela, I say, and follow him into the kitchen. Really? He removes the Glutov from the mass of blue tissue paper. It's an absolute gem. I suddenly realize that there is music in the background. It isn't very loud, and it is coming from some hidden speakers that diffuse the sound throughout the kitchen. Thy hand, Belinda, darkness shades me. On thy bosom let me rest. More I would, but death invades me. Death is now a welcome guest. When I am laid in earth. May my wrongs create no trouble, no trouble in thy breast. Remember me, but ah, forget my fate. Remember me, but ah, forget my fate. This is the death of Dido, from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. In my opinion, the most beautiful music for the human voice on earth. It is beyond beautiful. It is sublime, because of the incredibly dense succession of sounds, as if each were linked to the next by an invisible force, and while each one remains distinct, they all melt into one another at the edge of the human voice, verging on an animal cry. But there is a beauty in these sounds that no animal cry can ever attain, a beauty born of the subversion of phonetic articulation and the transgression of the careful verbal language that ordinarily creates distinct sounds. Broken steps, melting sounds. Art is life, playing to other rhythms. Let's go, says Kakuro, who has set cups, teapot, sugar, and little paper napkins onto a big black tray. I precede him down the corridor, and following his instructions, open the third door on the left. Do you have a VCR? That had been my question for Kakuro Ozu. And he had replied yes, with a cryptic smile. The third door on the left opens onto a miniature movie theater. A large white screen, a host of mysterious shiny devices, three rows of real seats covered in deep blue velvet, a long low table opposite the front row, and walls and ceilings covered in dark silk. Actually, it was my profession, says Kakuro.
Your profession?
For over 30 years, I imported high-end audio equipment to Europe for luxury establishments. It was a very lucrative business, but above all, marvelously entertaining for someone like me who is enchanted by the least little electronic gadget. I settle into a wonderfully plush seat, and the show begins. How to describe such moments of bliss? To be watching the Munekata sisters on a giant screen in gentle darkness, nestled against a soft backrest, nibbling glutov and drinking scalding tea in contented little sips. From time to time, Kakuro pauses the film and we both begin to talk about this and that. Camellias on the moss of the temple, and how people cope when life becomes too hard. Twice I go off to greet my friend, the Confutatis, and return to the screening room as if to a warm, cozy bed. This pause in time, within time. When did I first experience the exquisite sense of surrender that is possible only with another person? The peace of mind one experiences on one's own, one's certainty of self in the serenity of solitude, are nothing in comparison to the release and openness and fluency one shares with another in close companionship. When did I first feel so blissfully relaxed in the presence of a man? Today is the first time. Chapter 9. Sunny. At 7 o'clock, after much conversation and drinking of tea, I am ready to take my leave. And as we are passing through the living room, I notice, on a low table next to a sofa, the framed photograph of a very beautiful woman.
She was my wife, says Kakuro quietly,
seeing that I am looking at the picture.
She died 10 years ago, from cancer. Her name was Sane.
I am sorry. She was a very beautiful woman.
Yes, he replies. Very beautiful. There is a brief silence. I have a daughter who lives in Hong Kong, he adds, and already 2 grandchildren.
You must miss them.
I go there fairly often. I love them very much. My grandson, who is called Jack, his father is English, and who's 7, told me on the phone this morning that yesterday he caught his first fish. It's the event of the week, you can be sure. Another silence. I believe you are a widow, says Kakuro, escorting me to the front door.
Yes, I've been a widow for over 15 years. There is a catch in my throat. My husband was called Lucien. It was cancer, too.
We stand by the door and look at each other with sadness. Good night, Renee, says Kakuro.
And with a trace of our earlier lightheartedness, this has been a fantastic day. Melancholy overwhelms me at supersonic speed. Chapter 10. Dark Clouds. You are a sorry idiot, I say to myself, as I remove my plum-colored dress and discover some whiskey frosting on a buttonhole. What were you thinking? You're only a penniless concierge. Friendship across class lines is impossible. And anyway, what have you been thinking, you poor fool? What have you been thinking, poor fool? I say it over and over as I proceed with my evening ablutions, then slide between the sheets after a short battle with Leo, who does not want to yield any terrain. The lovely face of Sane Ozu is dancing before my closed eyes, and I see myself as a sad old thing, abruptly reminded of a joyless reality. My heart restless, I nod off. The next morning, I feel something not unlike a hangover. Nevertheless, the week goes by like a charm. Kakuro puts in a few spontaneous appearances to solicit my talents as an arbiter of taste. Ice cream or sorbet, Atlantic or Mediterranean, and I find the pleasure of his refreshing company unchanged, despite the dark clouds passing silently above my heart. Manuela has a good laugh when she sees the plum-colored dress, and Paloma has taken over Leo's armchair.
I'm going to be a concierge someday, she informs her mother. And Madame Josse herself looks at me with a fresh gaze, mingled with caution, when she comes to drop off her progeny at the loge.
May God preserve you from such a fate, I reply, with an amiable smile in Madame's direction. You're going to be a princess. Paloma is displaying in equal measure a candy pink t-shirt that matches her new glasses, the pugnacious air of girl who will be a concierge someday in the face of everything, especially my mother. What's that smell? She asks. There's a problem with the sewage in my bathroom, and it stinks like a barracks full of soldiers. I called the plumber 6 days ago, but he did not seem especially interested in coming. The drains, I reply, not terribly inclined to pursue the matter.
Failure of liberalism, says Paloma,
as if I had not said a thing. No, it's a blocked drain.
That's what I mean, says Paloma. Why hasn't the plumber come yet?
Because he's busy with other clients?
Not at all, she retorts. The correct answer is because he doesn't have to. And why doesn't he have to?
Because he doesn't have enough competition.
Exactly, says Paloma triumphantly. There is not enough regulation. Too many rail workers, not enough plumbers. Personally, I would prefer the Kolkhoz.
Woe is me. A knock on the window pane interrupts this captivating discussion. It is Kakuro, with an indescribably solemn air about him. He comes in and sees Paloma.
Good morning, young lady, he says. Well, Renee, shall I stop by later?
If you like. How are you?
Fine, fine, he replies.
Then, suddenly resolved, he takes the plunge.
Would you like to have dinner with me tomorrow evening?
I feel panic sweeping over me.
It's just that...
It is as if my vague intuitions of the last few days are suddenly taking shape.
I would like to take you to a restaurant that I'm particularly fond of, he continues, with the air of a dog hoping for a bone.
Restaurant? I say, feeling the full force of panic. On my left, Paloma makes a little squeaking sound.
Look, says Kakuro, who seems somewhat ill at ease. I really would like you to come. It's my birthday tomorrow, and I would be happy to have you as my dinner partner.
Oh, I say, incapable of adding anything.
I'm leaving to see my daughter on Monday, so I'll have a party with the family there, of course. But tomorrow evening, if you would...
He pauses briefly, looks at me hopefully. Is it just my impression, or is Paloma experimenting with apnea? Silence settles briefly over the room. Look, I say finally, really, I am sorry. I don't think it would be a good idea.
But why ever not?
Asks Kakuro, visibly disconcerted. It's very kind of you, I say, hardening my tone, for it has a tendency to go soft.
I am very grateful, but I'd rather not. Thanks all the same. I'm sure you have friends with whom you can celebrate the occasion.
Kakuro is looking at me, speechless. He says eventually.
Yes, of course, but, well, really, I would very much like... I don't understand,
He frowns.
Well, I just don't understand.
It's better this way, I say. Believe me. And walking toward him, to nudge him gently in the direction of the door, I add, we'll have other opportunities to chat, I'm sure. He retreats, looking like a pedestrian who has lost his sidewalk.
Well, it's a great pity, he says. I was so looking forward to it.
All the same, goodbye, I say, gently closing the door in his face. Chapter 11. Rain. The worst is over, I say to myself. But I have not yet reckoned with a candy pink destiny. I turn around and find myself face to face with Paloma, who does not look the least bit pleased.
May I know what on earth you are playing at?
She asks, in a tone that reminds me of Madame Billot, my very last schoolteacher. I'm not playing anything at all, I say weakly, aware of how childishly I have behaved.
Do you have anything special planned for tomorrow evening?
Well, no, but that's not why.
Then may I ask why, exactly?
I don't think it would be a good thing.
And why not?
Asks my police commissioner. Why not? Do I really know, to be honest? Just then, without warning, the rain starts to fall. Chapter 12. Sisters. All that rain. Where I grew up, in winter, it used to rain. I have no memories of sunny days, only rain. A weight of mud and cold, dampness sticking to our clothes and hair. Even when you sat by the fire, it never really went away. How often since then have I thought back on that rainy evening? How many recollections, over more than 40 years, of an event that reemerges today beneath that pouring rain? All that rain. My sister was named for an older child who'd been stillborn, who in turn had been named for a deceased aunt. Lisette was lovely, and even as a child I was aware of the fact, although my eyes had not yet learned to determine the shape of beauty, but only to divine its rough outline. As no one spoke in my home, nothing was ever even said, but in the neighborhood people gossiped, and when my sister went by, they would comment upon her beauty. So pretty and so poor. Fate is a brutish thing, the seamstress would mumble as we passed on our way to school. As for me, ugly and ungainly in mind and body, I would hold my sister's hand, and Lisette would walk, her head held high. And as she passed, she let them voice all the dire destinies predicted for her. For each of them had their own version. At the age of 16, she left for the town to look after some rich people's children. For a whole year, we did not see her. She came back to spend Christmas with us, bringing strange gifts, gingerbread, brightly colored ribbons, little pouches of lavender. She had the bearing of a queen. Could a rosier, livelier, more perfect face than hers exist? For the first time, someone was telling us a story, and we hung on her every word. We were avid for the mysterious awakening, and were eager to hear more from the lips of this farm girl who had become the maid of powerful people. She would tell us about a strange and richly colored and shining world, where women drove cars and went home at night to households filled with appliances that did the work of human beings, or gave them the news of the world. All you had to do was turn the knob. When I think back on all that, I take the measure of how destitute we really were. We were only 35 miles or so from town, and there was a market town scarcely 10 miles away. But we lived as people did during feudal times, without amenities or hope. So entrenched was our belief that we would always be backward peasants. No doubt even today in some remote rural backwater there are still some old people who have been cut off and have no idea of modern life. But in our case, we were all relatively young, and when Lisette began to describe the city streets all lit up for Christmas, we were discovering that there was a whole world out there. whose existence we had never even imagined. Lisette went off again. For a few days, as if through some sort of automatic inertia, we continued to talk a little bit. For a few evenings at table, the father commented on his daughter's stories.
Them some hard, strange stories.
Then silence and shouts rained down on us again, like a plague upon the unfortunate. When I think back, all that rain, all those deaths, Lisette bore the name of two women who had died. I had been given the name of only one, my maternal grandmother, who died shortly before my birth. My brothers all had first names of cousins who had been killed in the war, and my mother, too, had inherited her name from a cousin who had died in childbirth and whom she had never known. This was the wordless existence we were living, in a world of the dead, when one November evening, Lisette came back from the city. I remember all that rain, the sound of it drumming on the roof, the paths running with water, the sea of mud at the gate to the farm, the black sky, the wind, the horrible feeling of endless damp weighing upon us as our life weighed upon us. Neither consciousness nor revolt. We were sitting huddled together by the fire when suddenly my mother got to her feet, throwing the rest of us off balance. We watched in surprise as, driven by some obscure impulse, she headed to the door and flung it open. All that rain. Oh, all that rain. Framed in the door, motionless, her hair clinging to her face, her dress soaked through, her shoes caked with mud, staring lifelessly, stood Lisette. How did my mother know? How did this woman who, while never mistreating us, never showed us that she loved us, either by deed or word, how did this coarse woman who brought her children into the world in the same way she turned over the soil or fed the hens, this illiterate woman, so exhausted by life that she never even called us by the names she had given us, to the point where I at times wondered if she even remembered them, how had she known that her daughter, half dead, neither moving nor speaking, but merely staring at the door, without even thinking of knocking, was just waiting in a relentless downpour for someone to open and bring her into the warm room. Is this a mother's love? This intuition of disaster in one's heart? This spark of empathy that resists even when human beings have been reduced to living like animals? That is what Lucien said. A mother who loves her children always knows when they are in trouble. Personally, I do not much care for this interpretation, nor do I feel any resentment toward that mother who was not a mother. Poverty is a reaper. It harvests everything inside us that might have made us capable of social intercourse with others and leaves us empty, purged of feeling, so that we may endure all the darkness of the present day. Nor do I nurture any sturdy illusions. There was nothing of a mother's love in my mother's intuition, merely the translation into gesture of her certainty of misfortune. A sort of native consciousness, rooted deep in the heart, which serves to remind poor wretches like us that, on a rainy night, there will always be a daughter who has lost her honor and who will come home to die. Lisette lived just long enough to give birth to her child. The infant did what was expected of it. It died within 3 hours. From this tragedy, which to my parents seemed to be part of the natural order of things, so that they were no more and no less moved by it than if they had lost a goat, I derived two certainties. The strong live and the weak die, and their pleasure and suffering are proportionate to their position in the hierarchy. Lisette had been beautiful and poor. I was intelligent and indigent. But like her, I was doomed to a familiar punishment if I ever sought to make good use of my mind in defiance of my class. Finally, as I could not cease to be who I was either, it became clear to me that my path would be one of secrecy. I had to keep silent about who I was. And never mix with that other world. From being silent, I then became clandestine. Quite abruptly, I realize I am sitting in my kitchen in Paris, in this other world where I have made my invisible little niche, a world with which I have been careful never to mix, and I am weeping great warm tears, while a little girl with an incredibly warm gaze is holding my hand, gently caressing my knuckles. And I also realize that I have said it all, told her everything. Lisette, my mother, Lorraine, beauty profaned. And at the end of it all, the iron hand of destiny giving stillborn infants to mothers who die from wanting to be reborn. I am weeping plump, hot, long, good tears, sobbing tears. And while I am troubled, I am also incomprehensibly happy to see the transfiguration of Paloma's sad, severe gaze into a well of warmth where I can soften my sobs. "My God," I say, regaining my composure somewhat. "My God, Paloma, how silly I am." "Madame Michel," she replies, "you know, you are giving me hope again." "Hope?" I say, snuffling pathetically. "Yes," she says. "It seems it might be possible to change one's fate after all." We sit there for countless minutes, holding hands, not speaking. I have become friends with a lovely 12-year-old soul to whom I feel very grateful. And however incongruous this connection may be, asymmetrical in age, condition, and circumstances, nothing can taint my emotion. When Solange Just comes to the loge to fetch her daughter, Paloma and I look at each other with the complicity of indestructible friendship and say goodbye with the certainty we shall meet again soon. I close the door behind them and sit down in the armchair by the television with my hand on my chest. And I find myself speaking out loud. Maybe this, then, is what life is all about.
Profound thought number 15. If you want to heal, heal others, and smile or weep at this happy reversal of fate. You know what? I wonder if I haven't missed something. A bit like someone who's been hanging out with a bad crowd and then discovers another path through meeting a good person. My own personal bad crowd? Maman, Colombe, Papa, and their entire clique. But today, I was with a really good person. Madame Michel told me about this traumatizing event in her life. She has been avoiding Kakuro because she was traumatized by the death of her sister, Lisette, who was seduced and abandoned by some rich man's son. Don't fraternize with rich people if you don't want to die. Since then, this has become her survival technique. Listening to Madame Michel, I asked myself something. Which is more traumatizing? A sister who dies because she's been abandoned? Or the lasting effects of the event? The fear that you will die if you don't